Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. My guest for today is Carrie Bolden. Hey, Carrie, it's nice having you on.
It's nice to talk to you again.
So, Carrie, you have a new book out. It's called The Banking Swindle, Money Creation in the State.
That's correct, and it's available from Black House Publishing, a fairly new United Kingdom firm, for £14 that is now available directly from their website.
So I guess where I'd like to start off is this is something that's in the introduction to the book.
Yes.
And it basically, it says what usury is all about. Usury is sort of the ultimate centralization of power. And it talks about how the poorest 80% are the ones who pay the most interest to the richest 10%. And then it goes on, I mean, even the millionaires pay more interest than they receive to the billionaires. And that's basically, usury is basically the main reason why you have an obscene concentration of wealth.
Yes, that's correct. And it also means there's always a lack of purchasing power to actually consume production. So, you know, even at the best of times, goods produced are not being circulated and consumed sufficiently. But certainly, it's usury is the basis of, you know, what we have today in terms of globalization. And to me, it's one of the central issues that has largely been neglected by the right. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons why I wrote this book, because I threw a void. You know, there's quite a few books on finance and banking, but the right has largely forgotten its heritage, and really the ultimate rebellion which is required today is a rebellion against the power of the banks and the power of the usurers.
Basically, I mean, today when people hear the term right, it's basically synonymous with capitalism.
Yes, that's quite an irony, really, because, you know, I've recently been reading some of the works of Anthony Ludovici, etc., and, you know, he sort of traces the right in terms of the Anglophone world to the Cavaliers during the English Civil War of the 1600s, and, you know, the Puritans and the Roundheads, etc., were the from where the Whig Liberals derived from. And, you know, I'm always somewhat annoyed that in New Zealand and really the Anglophone world in particular, the term right is usually made synonymous with Whig Liberalism, especially by political scientists and journalists, you know, people that should know better. So the right has been largely defined wrongly. The right is fundamentally a rebellion against, you know, free market capitalism. It's not a representation of free market capitalism, and you have to go back to what is today called the right is really, in the English terms, Whiggery, classical liberalism. And another interesting aspect is that Karl Marx really recognised this. He states in his Communist Manifesto and elsewhere that he supports free trade and the free market because it's fundamentally a subversive method of economics that undermines tradition. And one of the major criticisms he had towards anyone in the Communist Manifesto is towards what he called reactionists. He saw a movement spreading, you know, at the time of the Industrial Revolution, etc., among what remained of craftsmen and preachers and small businessmen, etc., who wanted to go back to the pre-capitalist times of sort of the medieval era where economy was based on craft and, you know, one's calling was one's godly craft, etc. And he regarded that as an interference in what he called the wheel of history or what he called dialectics. So Marx considered capitalism or free market capitalism as an essential element of the dialectics of history, without which you couldn't have you know, the clash of opposites, which would lead to socialism and ultimately to communism. So when the so-called right is parading as the champions of the free market, they're really endorsing something that Marx saw as an essential ingredient of the dialectics of history. Whereas the traditional right, in the Anglophone world at least, goes back to the time of the English Civil War and the defence of the monarch who stood between the emerging merchant class and his people. And of course, Charles I was overthrown by Cromwell, who was heavily backed by foreign financiers, especially in Kent and the Netherlands at the time. So the right and free market capitalism are quite antithetical. I mean, free trade has more in common with Marxism than what it does with the traditional right.
One thing you say that's interesting about Marxism is because I, in an interview, I think it was with, it's actually a friend of mine, his name is Charles Lincoln. He's kind of into the kind of John Bircher type stuff. I'm personally not that crazy about that, but he's sort of making the argument that our current system is a communism because there's an abolition of private property. And I disagree with him about using the label communism to describe the current system, but he does have a legitimate point that under a usury-based economic system, there is a destruction of private. Nobody basically truly owns their property in the same way that Marx advocated.
Well, in both systems, it's basically a concentration of the economy. So he's right in terms of the economy being increasingly concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. Even I think it was H.G. Wells, as a Fabian socialist, commented that socialism is the high road of collectivism for the super rich, and that's why, as we discussed regarding my previous book, Revolution from Above, there's been a historical nexus between big finance and extreme left movements, which both basically squeeze out the smaller trader, etc. But nevertheless, I mean, what we have is maybe what you could call a communism of the wealthy, a concentration of political and economic power in the hands of the very few. So, I sort of drew a distinction between free market capitalism and, ordinary sort of small-scale private enterprise, which, certainly the right would endorse, but the so-called free market is not really free in the sense that the small elites that control the economic system of the world basically manipulate the market to suit themselves. So free market is basically a misnomer, but certainly we have an increasingly concentrated system, and once again Marx himself saw that one of the dialectical aspects of capitalism which he favoured was that increasing concentration, not only of wealth, but increasing internationalisation of capital. And that's, today we call it globalisation. So we're heading towards a concentration of wealth, which, in a way could be called the communism or the socialism of the extremely rich.
And there's never really been a strong opposition to usury from the left.
No. Their basis was really and still remains, soaking the rich. By rich, they basically mean the ordinary entrepreneur, and the ordinary sort of businessman. They seem quite oblivious to the factor of debt finance and usury. And one of the current aspects of the left, the Occupy movement, they couldn't really come up with anything other than facile slogans about, once again, soaking the rich and taxing the rich, etc., etc. And once again, what they mean by rich is your ordinary hapless bloody businessman trying to make ends meet just as much as anyone else with a huge mortgage and business probably indebted up to the hilt, etc. So that is, too, why I suppose the left has been historically many times backed by the wealthy plutocrats, because they don't challenge the fundamentals of the financial system. Even in the Soviet Union, that was sort of imploded through a state of colossal debt. It was billions at the time when it collapsed. So very few states have actually got themselves out of the financial quagmire, including even the communist states. And today, what remains of the communist states, such as Vietnam, even they're entering the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, and they're becoming, once again, heavily in debt to the international financial system.
So you really extensively cover the history of modern banking. So where does it really get started, actually, not in England, but in Holland?
Well, I was just consulting things again today, and, I noticed that Ezra Pound, in one of his brilliant little booklets, mentions the origins of a sort of usury-type system going back to Babylon about, 4,000 years ago when corn seed was used. They traded in corn seed, loans of corn seed in Babylon 3000 BC. In terms of our modern banking system, you had financiers entrenched in the Netherlands, and they were backing Cromwell basically, the City of London emerged as a financial system, and over time, bankers replaced the ordinary merchant until the city became one of the financial power centres of the world, and remains so.
You would say today it's more significant than New York is in terms of banking.
Well, I would regard personally New York as the prime centre. I think power shifted after World War II from Britain, including even the city, which is really a separate entity from Britain itself, to America, and America has assumed the position basically of the enforcer of the global economic system. I mean, during World War II, the old air colonial empires had become rather redundant, and the financiers wanted to broaden the scope of the influence beyond those old empires, and after World War II, they were basically scuttled with the help of America. And Roosevelt made it plain to Churchill that he wasn't just fighting Germany, he was going to ensure that all the old European colonial empires after World War II were destroyed in the name of free trade, and he uses those terms in regard to the Atlantic Charter, and that is precisely what happened. And, power sort of shifted. As it shifted from the Netherlands to the City of London, so thereafter, and, after World War II, it shifted from the city to New York. So I personally, you can't really think in terms of American bankers and British bankers and, Dutch bankers, etc. You just have to think in terms of international bankers, because they don't hold any particular loyalty to any particular race or nation, other than perhaps when, some of them are Jewish and still hold that loyalty to their own Jewish background.
Yeah, you wrote that you think people who make that the focus of the ethnicity of the bankers, do you view that as counterproductive?
Not so much counterproductive, it's not entirely accurate. I mean, who would say that someone like Rockefeller has prime loyalty to the United States, or some of the plutocrats who can change citizenship like they change their underwear are loyal to any particular nation state. What they're loyal to was their profits, and in a broader sense, probably somewhat loyal to their fellow plutocrats, where they all have backstabbing conclaves, Bilderberger conferences, etc. They don't hold any particular loyalty to any particular nation or system of government, just what serves them at any given time. It's what Stalin referred to as root this cosmopolitanism, basically.
Yeah, I know that you talk about it in your other book, Revolution from Above, the sort of the conflict with between Stalin and Trotsky.
Yes, and I've subsequently written another book published by Black House, Stalin, The Enduring Legacy, which focuses on that specifically. It's something that sort of interested me from the 1970s when, as a teenager, I was reading a newspaper from America called Common Sense, which talked about this divide between Trotskyism and Stalinism, and basically Trotskyism was and remains, in my opinion, the underlying ideology of American foreign policy. So, you know, there's quite a significant breach there, which was reflected in the Cold War. And I think we sort of owe Stalin an enduring thanks on two counts. One, getting rid of a bunch of bastards led by Trotsky in Russia, and two, by stymieing the post-war plans of the United Nations of the United States to create the United Nations as a world government. So whatever else you think of Stalin, I think we I'm a debt of gratitude on those two points alone.
And do you view the Axis regimes of World War II, Germany, Italy and Japan, as being opposed to usury?
Oh, definitely so. I mean, the right, in its eagerness to distance themselves from fascism and Nazism, tends to sometimes go to the opposite extreme and, you know, take on board a lot of the anti-Nazi wartime propaganda.
Or the other thing is,
you know,
a lot of the conspiracy shows, like people like Alex Jones, they say that those regimes were actually puppets of the bankers.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, bankers, as we know, will fund anything and everything. But the important points to remember were that, you know, Germany, all those three Axis states were issuing state credit. They weren't based on borrowing at all from the bankers. And another interesting point about Germany is that dividends were limited to 6%, and anything thereafter was went back into public works and the state, etc. All three countries had their state banking acts, including Italy and Japan, which issued state credit, and none of them borrowed from international finance. You know, I mean, once again, it's largely the libertarian right who, you know, like the left, you know, it's the what's been called Hitler and ad absurdum. You know, anything they're opposed to is called Nazi. I mean, you know, gun control is called Nazi, for instance, but in fact, you know.
Yeah, I was driving down the street. I saw a big poster today, a big poster on the long side of the street of Obama with a Hitler mustache.
Well, in fact, you know, as we should know, you know, gun control was quite lenient in Germany, and guns were quite readily available. Same with when someone raises the spectre of smoking, and you know, there wants to be there are moves to ban smoking in public. The cry goes up about health Nazis, you know, whereas in fact, you know, the National Socialist government undertook some quite considerable research into cancer, the link between cancer and smoking, which, if that had been heeded decades ago, might have saved a lot of lives. So, you know, I think we should look at these governments, these regimes, you know, even if we think they're horrendous, we should look at some of the achievements, especially in the socio-economic areas, and certainly Germany, Japan and Italy were prosperous states when the rest of the world was languishing in depression. And, of course, the great heralded New Deal didn't really get America out of the depression until United States went on a war economy footing, whereas Germany didn't actually go on a total war economy footing until several years into the war, which is another, you know, great myth. Germany's economic recovery was based on war production, whereas in fact it was Germany was recovering almost immediately that the National Socialists took power and started issuing state credit for public works. And interesting, the German banking system and issue of state credit was very much similar to New Zealand's Labour government state credit for financing our iconic housing program at the
was
time.
Was it social credit or something different?
Well, social credit reminds me a little bit of leftist doctrine. There's a lot of arguments about the correct interpretation of social credit, which has split the movement over, you know, points of doctrine. And the orthodox social creditors state that state credit is actually socialistic and you shouldn't do it. It should be issued by some sort of public corporation or something. But what the advocates of state credit have often done is looked at Major Douglas's analysis of the financial system, seen where that's correct, and applied the solutions in a slightly different way, and that is by using state credit. And New Zealand was one of those which did that. They issued 1% state credit to the tune of initial run of $5 million, then $10 million, or pounds, and then $10 million to create state houses, and that cured something like 75% of the unemployment rate in New Zealand at the time. And around about, this is around 1935 or so, and around about the same time, Germany was doing exactly the same by issuing state credit for public housing and other public works. But one of the main differences is that under a Fabian Labor government, the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance were actually very reluctant to inaugurate a state credit system, even though that had been the basis of their electoral victory. And they only did so under much pressure led by the iconic New Zealand Labour politician John A. Lee, who basically pushed that through as Under Secretary of Housing. Whereas in Germany, they undertook state credits and public works on a vaster scale, you know, much more vast than New Zealand ever achieved. But once again, that shows you where Fabian socialism or the left stand on such issues. You know, it's the Labour Party's policy on state housing was forced through basically in opposition from its own government. Likewise in Australia, King O'Malley, who was Minister of Home Affairs, he had to fight against his Labour colleagues and government to get through the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. And even when that was inaugurated, was eventually stymied into not issuing state credit. But fortunately, the governor, the first governor of that bank, Sir Denison Miller, went ahead regardless and issued credits based on the reserve of savings of the bank and issued 1% loans, which funded the entire war expenditure during the First World War, to the tune of something like $700 million at less than 1%. But the Commonwealth Bank of Australia was taken over by orthodox economists in 1924, and it was privatised in 1999. So, you know, once again, some of these great financial reforms have actually been pushed through grassroots resistance, through grassroots pressure, you know, against the resistance of the Labour Party hierarchies.
So the way, doesn't the way social credit work is that money, the money that is introduced, the money that's introduced goes directly to the people?
Well, one of the main points of social credit is a national dividend, and that's issued according to estimates of the lack of products and goods produced, and the discrepancy between that and the amount of purchasing power. So each household, as far as I understand, social credit would be issued with a dividend, usually annually, to make up the shortfall between produce and purchasing power. And they have a system called the A plus B theorem, which basically A means wages and B means expenditure on interest rates, etc. A plus B means costs, but only A means spending power available through wages. So social credit tries to make up that discrepancy by eliminating the overheads on interests, plus pulling in a national dividend, paying directly to the people as a form of increasing the purchasing power. That is, so far as I understand social credit. I mean, it gets quite technical, and I don't really regard myself as a social creditor as such, but, as I say, it gets rather dogmatic, and there are social credit purists, and there are others who just generally take the theory and go with that and change according to circumstances. But there have been many other theorists apart from Major C.H. Douglas. One, for instance, prior to Douglas was Arthur Kitson, who unfortunately I don't cover in my book, but he was basically advocating what is now probably called quantitative easing with the issue of currency into circulation, according to the productivity of the time. So that was Arthur Kitson. He had a major influence on banking reformers such as Soddy and Irving Fisher, and on the experiments undertaken in Germany and local currencies such as the Vora in Germany and the local currency issued in Virgil, Austria. And even in the United States during the Depression, local currencies became quite fashionable, such as in Howard and Iowa in 1932 and other states in the US. And in Alberta, when the Social Credit Party came to power in 1935-36, they were stymied by the central government into issuing their own credit, so they issued prosperity certificates, which amounted to the same thing. And interestingly also, a modern example was the Ora, a local currency issued in the Afrikaans enclave Orania, and they have their own local currency.
That's another thing to point out. I saw your article about South Africa. The thing is the supposedly leftist regime of the ANC is totally in. They've actually allowed a lot of privatization and let these multinational corporations exploit their natural resources.
Exactly. Funnily enough, that's a point I'm dealing with in yet another book that I'm finishing off at the moment for Black House on globalization and multiculturalism. And one of the points I make is that when the colonial powers were forced out of their empires, and especially in Africa, when black rule emerged, that really was just a facade for the global corporations to move in. And of course, the latest example is the complete lackey attitude of the ANC Communist Coalition towards globalization. And as you say, all the old parastatals or governments, state-owned enterprises that were created by the Afrikaners are being sold off to the international corporations. So that's once again an example of how we see the left and being in accord with international finance. But Orania is quite an interesting enclave, and so far as that they actually are creating what the green left spouts about with the banal slogans, the Afrikaner there is creating a little community based on permaculture, and you know, everything's based on ecological development, and they're actually exporting crops while, you know, the entire state of Zimbabwe is now importing crops. So it's a very successful example of a small community, which is only 1,000 people, and it is basically self-sustaining and self-contained, although of course, you know, they're not completely free of the South African financial system. They still have to work with the rand, but the rand is exchanged for the ora, and the ora becomes a local currency, and it's even used by some of the surrounding communities. And, of course, the ora is kept within Orania, and the bank there is a cooperative. So it's an encouraging way a small community is actually opting out of the global system and trying to retain its identity.
You talk about the left. Have there been any sort of left, either leftist regimes or leftist movements that have genuinely been opposed to the international banking and corporate globalization?
Well, you know, once again, I see the Soviet Union after Lenin and Trotsky is attempting to retain the sovereignty of Russia and the sort of empire they created, even though they still had to operate within the world trade system. You know, but that's an example, I think, of how even Stalinism wasn't really able to quite get rid of the excrescences of the old system. You know, I suppose Shave has bucked the system. I guess Cuba to some extent also. Vietnam is succumbing to the global system. So, on the whole, the left has done a rather poor job of opposing capitalism. I think it's the legacy of the right to oppose capitalism. That was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because, I mean, we're in the depths of a world debt crisis, and, you know, the right has been virtually silent on the subject, and yet it was the right which is historically heralded opposition to the international bankers, like, you know, Father Charles Coughlin and the United States during the Depression, and even in New Zealand.
Yeah, and to point out, Coughlin was opposed. Yeah. His main opponents were actually the communists, as well as the Democrats.
Yeah. Of course, you had the communists fighting the young Coughlinites on the streets. You know, the Coughlinite newspaper sellers of social justice fighting them on the streets, and just as you have today, the left fighting the right on the streets, and the establishment coming out on the side of the left against the right. You know, it seems to me, whether by accident or design, the left, the street rabble, has always served the establishment. You know, I mean, the communist myth is that fascism served as the vast refuge of the capitalists, but I think rather it was a matter of the communists projecting their own failings onto their opposition, and that the left is actually the last refuge of the capitalist system, and ensuring that their opponents are, you know, are stifled. You know, we saw it recently in France with the attack on some skinheads by the left, and it's the right that gets banned, and the left that gets heralded as the heroes. Coughlin, once again, that was a movement that was opposed from, you know, both above and below. Like a lot of movements, of course, you know, the fascists in Europe were another example. It was happening all over the world at the time. And, the Depression served as a great impetus for the formation of movements that were trying to consider genuine alternatives. In Britain, you had the Green Shirts, and in New Zealand, even, you had a 20,000-strong Green Shirt New Zealand Legion, which advocated social credit. And, in Quebec, you had the Pilgrims of St. Michael, which is still going and which retains the old zeal of the social credit movement. It's a Catholic-based organization, and it still retains the enthusiasm that the social credit movement had during the 1930s, but which seems to have somewhat washed out in later years.
And you also talk about some of the regimes in the Middle East, like Syria and Iran.
Well, I mentioned Muslim banking. You know, Muslim banking, like traditional Catholic social doctrine, as opposed to usury on religious grounds, as a sin.
But traditional Muslim banking, but the sort of the most of the Sunni Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Jordan, they're all totally in with international capitalism.
Yes, yep.
So I see a trend where there's more opposition to globalization from the sort of Shia sphere, rather, and the Sunni sphere is more sort of in with globalization.
Yeah, it seems to be the case, and of course we saw, people like Gaddafi targeted, and the Iraqis and Iranians, and some of these regimes, they still retain a modicum of independence. And I haven't looked into the details of the states, the Muslim states and their banking systems, but I guess if something's listed on the axis of evil, both states are doing something, as opposed to globalization and international finance. For instance, I think Iran basically has a barter system, which is always, an interesting aspect of opposition to international finance. And there are other states in the Middle East, I believe, that had barter. Some years ago, Iran actually offered oil for New Zealand lamb, but that was turned down by New Zealand. This is going back decades now, because it would interfere with New Zealand's, relations in the international banking system. So, barter is very much an important part of opposition to international finance, and once again we find the Axis states are engaged in barter, and one of the chief concerns of the states that were arraigned against Germany was that Germany was taking over all the markets in Eastern Europe and even South America, because they were offering to barter. So that was one of the causes of the war, according to the findings of people like the Duke of Bedford, etc. Barter and state credit are basically the principles of withdrawing from a usurious system.
And there's also the public banking movement.
Yes, I don't know a lot about that. I know that Dr. Alan Brown seems to be doing a good job in the United States. But certainly public banks, you can even go back to the Pollyon of France, where basically the Bank of France, they had limited dividends of 6% and loans issued at 2% interest. And, the Medici Bank in Tuscany, that issued loans at 5% interest and limited dividends at 5%. And the rest were put back into public work. So public banking institutions have a long and successful pedigree, from a variety of fields.
So before we wrap up the interview, what are some of the most significant things about the book that you haven't covered yet?
Well, as I say, I sort of missed out Kitson, who's an interesting character and provided the background for many right-wing thinkers, including Arnold Leese, first got interested in politics through...
Did he predate C.H. Douglas?
Yes, he did. He was talking about these matters in the 1890s. He is quite a successful inventor of lights that were used in lighthouses, etc., and many other patents. And he was basically talking about issuing interest-free currency. And what I could have covered further is that I recently did an article for the journal Ab Eterno, which I helped to publish and edit, on parties, which the outlooks of different right-wing parties on the banking system. And what we often call, or the media often calls, extreme right-wing and even neo-fascist, such as a lot of the anti-immigration Scandinavian parties and the Swiss People's Party, etc.
There is a difference in Europe. In the United States, I mean, the right wing is totally, they're full-blown capitalists, but I think in Europe they're not as hyper-capitalist as the
The thing I found was that in some of these anti-immigrant so-called extreme right parties, they are actually like the Americans. They embrace what they call classical liberalism and do actually advocate free market economics. But there are other parties, such as down this way, the Australia First Party, and in Germany you've got the National Democrats and Golden Dawn Jobbik in Hungary, New Force in Italy, and of course Casa Pound in Italy, and the British Democratic Party, a very new breakaway from the BNP. All these have, at least broadly, a positive outlook on the banking system and the need for reform. The French National Front seems to be a bit vague on the subject, but the parties have just listed, or the organisation have just listed, they do seem to recognise the need, or, you know, the crucial issue of dealing with the banking system. So parties which are often regarded as right and even so-called neo-Nazis, such as, you know, these Scandinavian parties, such as the Danish People's Party and the Austrian Freedom Party, actually, etc., they actually still seem to adhere to free market economics. But there is another grouping of parties which do tackle the need for major economic reforms.
And in the United States, I mean, basically, well, sort of outside this side, the site Countercurrents and this kind of circle, there's basically, I mean, there's the Public Banking Institute, but
yes.
If you look at the movements in the United States, we have the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, and we have basically nothing really of value in this country.
No, well, I had trouble finding anything in the United States that talked about, you know, as a right-wing party, talked about finance. So I thought that the American Third Position Party talked about it, but they've changed their name to the American Freedom Party, and they don't seem to have anything on tackling the banking system at all. I'm not sure. I seem to recall when it was called the American Third Position Party having something on the Federal Reserve and the banking system, etc.
Yeah, the labels, I mean, third position sort of emphasizes, and actually in opposition to capitalism, American Freedom Party just sounds kind of like another kind of right-wing third party.
So I don't know what happened to their position on banking. Anything connected with Willis Carto seems to be sound in regard to banking, but I don't think he's backed a party since the Populist Party. But as you say, America seems to be somewhat destitute of right-wing parties that that deal with the banking issue, which, you know, once again is one of the reasons I wanted to write a book of this nature, because, I mean, you know, as I say, we're in the midst of a debt crisis, and you know, people still talking about bloody, you know, Jews and all these other things that have been, you know, talked about endlessly for decade after decade. I mean, we don't need any more books on Jews. One of the criticisms I had of Revolution from Above was it wasn't a full scale attack on Jews. Well, you know, haven't we got enough on that subject? Do we really need another book? I mean, you know, I wanted to emphasise and focus on other things which are rarely mentioned, and the same with the banking swindle. you know, although I mentioned Jews in here, I mean, you know, it's not just a book about attacking Jewish international finance, etc. It's really aimed at dealing with this great void we have in the right and opposing.
Yeah, even if you look at someone like George Lincoln Rockwell, he was kind of a right winger in the sense that he was obsessed purely about the ethnic angle. He was a conservative. His economic view was a very shallow, and he actually was very much, he supported the American capitalist.
I think he was a conservative who wanted to make a bigger noise with the swastika and got, you know, because he got frustrated with the conservative movement, he thought using the swastika might be the way to break through the silence. I think he mentions in White Power, he actually does mention something similar to the national dividend, which I thought was rather interesting. So he must have been acquainted somewhere along the line with something like social credit. But of course, you know, he started off calling himself World Union of Free Enterprise National Socialists, which seems a bit of a misnomer to me. But, you know, once again, there's all this great heritage from the 1930s of Charles Coughlin in particular. And, you know, Congressman McFadden and Gertrude Coogan with her book The Money Creators, all this great stuff has basically been put down the memory hole, and what we have, well, seem to have now, you know, especially going by what you've just said, is a bunch of, you know, free market crap, basically, which is...
I mean, that is what I said about, I brought up the John Bircher thing. That's really kind of the beginning of it. My take on the Birchers were, it was sort of a way to appeal to, like, some of those people who were kind of Coughlinites, but direct them, get them really obsessed with communism, and then they sort of turn the blind eye to the plutocracy.
Yeah. Well, they don't offer solutions to it. They have, you know, from the start, pointed out that there's international bankers and what they call the East Coast establishment, you know, that back communism, but they haven't offered a solution to that other than the free market. And, you know, as I said, I don't believe there's anything free about the free market. It's whatever's manipulated by the people that hold the purse strings, and if you don't cut the purse strings, you're not going to achieve anything. So that is why, to me, you know, dealing with the financial system is a major issue, you know, because it strikes at the root of the power of these people that are trying to globalize the world, and, you know, things like immigration and even, you know, race, they're byproducts. They are byproducts and not they're symptoms of what's wrong. You know, and focusing just on points of immigration, race, Jews, etc., are actually neglecting what is at the back of all these things.
Well, Kerry Bolden, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Well, it's been excellent to talk to you again. It's a pleasure, and I remember last time when we spoke about revolution from above, and I very much enjoyed speaking to you.
Well, thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thank you.